Okay, we have seen that salvation is a crisis that initiates us into a process. Have you got that by now? That when you came to Christ, you still had all the old leaves hanging on you. The miracle is Jesus now lives at our heart. We are a new creation, a new I, a new self. What we have to do now is discover who that new self is. Because up until now, we've been trying to find ourselves in all our false and phony faces. What you want me to be, what you want me to be, what I think of myself to be, and so on and so on. And now I've come to Jesus, he resurrects my true self. And I have to come to that true self and know my true self. And at that time, the old selves drop off. All the phoniness and the denials and all that I try to pretend I was has got to go. And it does go in his good time and agenda. And so that's what we're doing in this seminar. We're seeing how we are being saved from a worldview that we had that was distorted by the lie. We're being saved from all the distorted views that we held about God, because anything we knew about God before we came to Christ has been distorted by the lie. Whatever you believed about God before you came to Christ, you did think you had to work for him to get his approval. And that was the lie. That's a satanic view of God. We have to have our brains turned around, the renewal or the renovating of our mind, so that we now think about ourselves differently, as people made in God's image and loved by him. And I begin to think of you differently, for I see that you are loved, that you are made in God's image, and so on. We're being saved from all the effects of the lie, and specifically the effects of the lie in our personality. The lie as it has been seen by others who, because they believed the lie, they abused us. And so we are people that have been blitzed and shattered and broken by the lie. Now, the lie started in the Garden of Eden. And it has ended up in this year, in the 20th century. How did it get here? How did you end up like you ended up? How did it get from there to you? The word in the scripture is iniquity. There's a verse that upsets a lot of people. It is certainly not a verse you want to hang on your wall. In Exodus 20, where it says, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. We'd like to put that verse out of the Bible, except there's a lot more verses like it. Iniquity has often been confused with sin, as if the word sin means the same as the word iniquity. It doesn't. Iniquity is sin, but it is sin as it releases energy into those who follow me. So when a person sins, that's sin. Iniquity is that sin as it affects my children's 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 children. It is sin as it is an energy that goes on through the bloodline. An energy that causes whole families to be caught up into its effects. The word iniquity means twisted or bent. And so it is sin as to be seen as the energy that can twist and bend a whole family. Have you noticed that there are certain sins that seem to flourish in your family? Has anyone ever said you're just like your father? Anyway, you know, it was your grandfather, he was just like that. It seems to be passed on. There's something. The way I sin, no man sins to himself. That is part of the lie. We think because we're in the darkness that no one's affected by it. Every time we sin, we are passing on an energy into our family. It's something like a relay race. You know, the baton is passed on one to the other. And there's a Smith baton. And my great-great-grandfather had a twist on that baton, and when he passed it to my great grandfather, he twisted it a bit more, and then my grandfather a bit more, my father. By the time he comes to me, this baton called the Smith life that happens in the Smith clan is twisted and bent in a specific way that has been custom made by my generations. You see, when you look at me, well, no, let's backtrack. When I would say this, I came to Christ. Well, who is that I that came to Christ? Is the I that came simply that mass of emotions and thoughts and feelings that occurred in that meeting when I came to Christ? No, The I that came to Christ has roots deep. If you want to go back far enough, I go back to Adam. So do you. And so if you want to go back that far, then I am involved in that shame base that came out of the Garden of Eden. That's why I still act like my father Adam many times. I still want to blame shift and disassociate myself or grovel in shame because that's my original family. And it's there. And I know that's not fair, but it's the way the human race is, you see. Supposing your great-grandfather had dropped dead at birth, where would you be today? Okay, they call that the unity of the human race. You can't avoid it. You are involved in Adam, whether you like it or not. But then you see, down through the race, there were many splits off. And from Adam, you ended up with the English folk. And I mean, I'm part Viking. You remember the Vikings? Those pirates and playboys that came across from Denmark and Europe, and they even had a special line in the Church of England prayer book that they prayed every night in ancient England. Lord, deliver us from ghosties and gowlies and things that go bump in the night. And that was the Vikings who went bump in the night. And I'm the result of a Viking raid. they came, and I'm part Viking, if you go back that far. Now, I'm not about to say that desperately affects me today, but I do come. You see, I do come from there, don't I? I don't come from Tulsa. And you see, and that's why I think as I do. Do you understand it? You see, I don't think like an American. I've been here a long time, but I still don't think like an American because I've got roots. You see, I go, that's the I that came to Christ. And that I is a mixture of all that stuff, you see. And then in my family, back through my grandparents and great-grandparents, there were certain rejections. We were a very, aristocratic family in London. In fact, there's a house in London today, you have to pay a dollar to get in, and that's where my family came from. Only my branch of the family was thrown out because of alcoholism. And my branch of the family drank themselves into the gutter. And the awful rejection of that, the abandonment, that's it's in my family, and it wasn't too long ago. These hurts, those unique sins that were picked up back there at forks in the road, the griefs that came to the family, the methods by which my family dealt with their hurts, it was all picked up by the next generation. It was part of the baton that was passed on, and that was what was given to me, you see. Now, let me say something very clearly. You can underline this in red. In saying what I'm saying, I am not laying blame on my parents or my grandparents and excusing myself for the way I live. My parents are responsible to God for what they did. End of discussion. I am totally responsible to God for the way I react to what they did. I am not responsible for their actions. I'm responsible to God for my actions. So do not interpret anything I say as blaming my parents and saying, poor me. I am responsible, whatever they did. Now, the ideal family, that elusive functioning family, it starts with God. God who is unconditional love. And he fills the mother and the father with unconditional love. And they know him and they know that they're made in his image. They respond to that outside voice that speaks love. They know their identity. And so when Junior comes into the family, Junior is secure because he is secure in the parents' security in the love of God. He has an identity because his parents speak his identity as being made in God's image and loved unconditionally by God. He is in a family that has meaning to their existence because they know of whence they come. Out of their fullness, they give to the child unconditional love. And when the child comes of age, the child is ready now to have a direct, immediate knowledge of God who loves unconditionally. That's a functioning family. But the fall brings in sin. And the families of the earth have been bent and twisted at the roots. And so for most of us, thank God if it wasn't so, but for most of us, our parents had empty hearts that were not filled with the unconditional love of God. That meant they had pain-filled hearts. And the pain was so intense that they were totally involved in trying to fill the emptiness and anesthetize the pain. And they had no love to give to the child, and they wouldn't know how to give it if they had it. In fact, many of them were addicted in order to stop their own pain. They had nothing to give, but they did have something to give. They passed on iniquity. They passed on the twist and the bend that they had received. And you were a little child in such a family. Now, let me tell you something about little children. They do not have editing controls. You know what I mean by that? We adults have an edit control. At least if we've grown up in our minds, we do. That means that if you come to me and you really get mad at me and call me nasty names, well, I can edit that. You know, I can say, well, I think they're having a bad day. I can, you know, edit a bit. And therefore, I don't think you really believe what you're saying. But also, I can edit out and I can say, I know that that's not true about me. I can clip that out. I'm capable of editing the whole conversation. But a child has no ability to edit. Whatever a child hears in word or action or inference, if it is in terms of abuse, that child interprets that immediately as, I'm unlovable, I'm worthless. Do you understand me? If there comes to the child, whether it be by word or action, any kind of abuse, whether it be passive abuse or active abuse, the child can't edit that and say, my dad's got a problem. Rather, I interpret that I must be unlovable. I must be worthless. And so this now becomes the fuel to the shame that is already there in my background. I came into the arena bearing a basic shame of the whole human race. Are you with me? You understand? I got that from my forefather Adam. But now they're putting logs on the fire. Now with their abuse, passive and active, they are now fueling my shame. They are causing me to affirm that I am a shame-filled person. They're magnifying it, and I come out of childhood with a load of shame upon my shoulders. And a child that is being shamed, that is a child who is receiving messages that say you are unlovable and unworthy, that child will rapidly learn to react to that by manipulating the situation, lying, as we saw in the last hour, doing what he feels will gain some kind of love in a loveless situation. And iniquity has already begun. You've got the hang of this? When the parent does this, the child reacts like this, and the twist has started. And so the parent sin, the child reacts, and the only way it knows to react is with more sin, only it carries it around. And so the twist, the bend of the human race, begins again in this particular case. What about some of the things I'm talking about? Let's get practical here. Abuse, I don't think I need to identify that too much. We know what that is. I'm talking about physical abuse, when you are beaten unmercifully. I'm talking about verbal abuse. I'm talking about emotional abuse. I'm talking about sexual abuse. And I might say this, that in an audience of this size, there are many of you here who have been physically and emotionally abused, verbally abused, and many of you have been sexually abused. And I say that because I know what you feel. You feel you're the only one who is like this, and you feel shame. You see, I want to hide this. I don't want to admit it. And I want you to know there are many, many here. And I believe Jesus will walk into that situation before tonight. But all of that brings to that, that's fuel to this fire. That adds to the shame. It tells the child you're unlovable, you're not worth knowing, you're only worth beating. An adopted child often feels that their true parents, whoever they are, wherever they are, abandoned them and rejected them. However foolish that may be on the table, seeing as they've been raised by loving parents, yet in their heart they still feel that at some point in time they've been rejected. Did you know that if there was a death of a parent when you were a child, you felt in your little child heart that the parent had rejected you, walked out on you by dying? The parents that were absent from home on a job and gone for weeks, many times the little child interprets that the parent has gone because you're not lovable enough to be around. A divorce, of course, can do that. I hardly need to comment on that. Did you have a parent who was physically present but actually absent? You know what I mean? I remember I was raised in London during the war, and it was traumatic enough. My father was gone in the war, and I lived all my early childhood being dragged out of the crib, wrapped in a blanket, thrown in the bomb shelter with the parent flying on top of me and laying there where the bombs fell all around us. First thing I learned in kindergarten was how to put on a gas mask and how to identify the missiles. And there was no love. There was no love. And I mean, I do not remember in my entire childhood ever being hugged. I never remember sitting on a parent's lap. I never remember anyone saying they loved me. To us, the nearest you got to any warm, nice feeling was the all clear siren, which said the air raid's over and you've made it through another one. And that was the warmest feeling you ever had. I came out of the war and we were dirt poor. And so my father had to have three jobs in order to survive. Well, the only time I saw my father was when he was asleep in the chair at night. I never knew my father at all. He wasn't there in my earliest childhood, and then afterwards, he really wasn't there, though he was there. He was just asleep. And I didn't know what love was. My heart was a desert and a vacuum sucking for anything you could lay hands on. I'll come back to that maybe. But do you know what I mean by a parent who is there but not there? The one who is engrossed in TV. Well, and all you wanted to do was sit beside him or her. And as you come, they say, go away, can't you see I'm watching TV? And that's all they ever did. And you never knew them because they were never available there. Can't you see I'm tired? Be quiet. Play somewhere else. Go away. They were there, but they weren't there. And of course, all that's interpreted in our little child minds that we're the ones who are unlovable. See, now I can go back and reinterpret my history and understand what was going on in those days of hell on earth in London. But then I didn't know. All I knew that I wasn't worth holding. My skin was crying out to be held. I wanted just someone to hold me tight. I didn't know what was going on. And the little child doesn't realize. All it receives is the messages. You're no good. You're not worth having around. You're unlovable. Was your parent absent from what was so important to you? You're absent from what you were doing, so that no interest in your school projects. It didn't matter what you did. How you were honored at school, it was passed over at home. No one ever praised you for the work you did. They were never there at the important game. Remember how you searched the bleachers because they promised to be there, but they never were. And that was all interpreted. You see, I'm unlovable. I'm not worth having around. Were you verbally abused? Someone sticking their face right into your private space and screaming into your face, what in the world are we going to do with you? Or to look at you as if you crawled out from under a stone and said, what did I deserve to get you? Or you'll never amount to a thing. Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you be as pretty as your sister? After all we've done for you, look what you've done. Or you'll be the death of me yet. Can you tell me what makes you so stupid? Or if you had the misfortune of being raised in a religious home, would Jesus be pleased with what you've done? And you make a mental note never to meet this Jesus. Or God doesn't love naughty little girls. You get the picture. Now, understand me. I say it again, that with no editing controls, those words I just said, incidentally, I took them from a list of the most used words by parents when they verbally abuse children. And when you hear them, you get the same message. I'm worthless, you see. After all I've done for you, what kind of a worthless person am I that I don't have any gratitude? You know, I can't edit that. I'm unlovable. I'm no good. And if you've been in the religious home, then you feel unlovable to God and you'll never be any good for God. But let me say this. I am a parent. And parents are driven sometimes beyond all endurance by frustrating, irritating, exasperating children. And you well might have said that sometimes. That's not verbal abuse. Verbal abuse is when you get that thrown at you day after day after day without any positive affirmations. Affirm positively 20 times and then you're allowed to say one of those. But if you say that all the time and just throw in an odd affirmation, that's verbal abuse. Were you raised in that religious home, that rigid fundamentalist home, where the father was the dictator, imposing the final and the only way of thinking, where love, the only way you understood love was, it was gained by adhering to the rules, that correct performance. A religious home, I mean, one where there was no mercy for failure. Those cold, harsh homes. Were you taught to despise? Despise everybody of another denomination? Your denomination was the only one right? Were you despising those of another color, those of another race? All that happens in religious homes, tragically. Did you learn denial and hypocrisy from your father, who seemed to have another standard than what he preached? And let his friends get off the hook too. See, a religious home brought with it a pervading atmosphere of rejection. You're never good enough. You're forsaken because you can't keep the rules properly. You live in a state of shame and unworth. Forever being asked, what would the neighbors say? You can't do that, what would they say? Until you feel that you're just absolutely worthless. In fact, so many times it finally exploded in your teenage. You said, I'll never be good enough. I'll go to hell instead. And then the parents came to the pastor and says, I don't know what went wrong. They had such a good upbringing. They were raised in religion, not Jesus. And that is abuse. It's religious abuse. And we're the victims. As I read your eyes and hear your hearts, there's many here. And you fitted into those abuses. We see, watch how iniquity functions. All that was the sins of unlove being heaped upon you. Now, how did we react? See, we're going to twist the baton a little bit more. We reacted to that as we came into adulthood. If we had no love as children, there is a craving, it is a longing that has got to be the greatest energy in the human race, a longing for love. We'll take it anywhere we can get it. I came out of teenage with a craving for love, looking back in retrospect. A craving to be loved, to receive some sense that I'm worth something, I have importance. And it's a long story, enough to say that I received the baptism of the Holy Spirit when I was 14. And within 4 or 5 days of that, I was preaching my first sermon. And I've been preaching ever since. But this is the point. See, we would say, wouldn't we, the baptism of the Holy Spirit, that's the crisis that makes everything right. No, that was the way God began the process of making everything right. It was going to take 17 years before I even began to know what he was doing. Because, you see, when I walked on the platform, I will never forget, when I tell this story, I can feel the sensations I had in my body. When I walked on the platform at 14 years old, my parents were sitting just down there. And for the first time in my life, I felt something that was almost tangible coming up from them and embracing me. They were proud of me. I was important to them. It was the first time I felt anything like it. And it wasn't only them, though. That was where the energy was coming from. It was coming from all over the place because these were people who knew me as part of the church. And it was coming from them. I know him. You know, he's one of our boys. He's in the youth group. And I felt, if you're a preacher, you know what I mean. You stand up here and you know what the people are thinking about you. And for a 14-year-old who was starving for love, it was coming at me from all over. And all I had done was walk into a pulpit and open my Bible. I was hooked on preaching as much as a wino is hooked on his bottle. From that day, I had my God substitute. It was preaching the gospel. Does that make sense? I had to preach. I went over the whole of England and Ireland, Scotland, Wales, America and Canada. I went, I had to. I couldn't say no. You asked me to preach, I had to say yes. Because that's where I got my sense of identity. You asked me in those days, who are you? And I would have said, I am a preacher. See, I identified myself in terms of what I did. Because I didn't know who I was. That's where I got my identity.
There are other places. You can cling to your mate. You become a clinger to friends. You daren't let them out of your sight. You're terrified they will reject you and abandon you, as you already have been over and over again. You go through life having multiple affairs. You just want someone to hold you, someone to tell you that you're lovable, that you have some worth to you. If you're one of those that has been put down for failure and mistakes, to the point where you despise yourself for not being perfect, you now are on a marathon of trying to produce the most perfect work. You're never satisfied. You don't know what drives you after more and more and more. You're earning money that you don't need and never will need, but you feel you have to prove something. You're trying to prove that all that you heard as a child was wrong. You are worth something. Look what I'm doing. In fact, many times part of that twist that comes out of what was done to us is a seeking love in possessions. We're driven to have the latest, the best, usually unneeded stuff, because that becomes our identity. My car is my identity. The neighborhood I live in is my significance, my security. In fact, we even say this. We talk about a fellow and we'll say, how much is he worth? Do you hear what you just said? You are identifying a man's worth with his bank account? We'll publish it in magazines that he's worth so much. Do you hear what I'm saying now? All of us, we do this. We see worth in things and possessions and monies and bank accounts. You see, we're craving for importance. We didn't get it. So we're going to get it now, but we're getting it with the twist. What was given to us, shame, we're now twisting it. And it's the same thing. It just goes on from there. Goes on and on. We seek in significance. I tell you, in many of our churches, they're racked and torn by gossip. What is gossip? Gossip is iniquity. See, someone comes to you, and remember, inside you're feeling that you're unlovable and worthless. You're not important. Someone comes to you and says, now, I haven't told anybody else. Oh, they're going to share it with me.